When the Australian Federal Police arrived in Bali just days after the 2002 bombings that took the lives of over 200 people, the Indonesians were reluctant to let them on the scene, let alone assist in the investigation. Despite this, AFP forensic scientist David Royds would soon find evidence that neither the Indonesian nor Australian authorities wanted in the headlines, and that is that the explosion had come at the hands of a suicide bomber. It was a theory that would take a couple of months to confirm through a meticulous interpretation of forensic evidence. The Bali bombing is just one of 16 cases profiled in Liz Porter's new book, Crime Scene Asia, When Forensic Evidence Becomes the Silent Witness. I think she can see a television series coming along with that title, which looks at how forensics have been used to solve major crime throughout Asia, just published here by Blue Sky. Liz, welcome back.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you for having me.
The true crime genre has been big business in Australia and the US, but you're somewhat of a pioneer for the Asian market. It was a Hong Kong bomb plot from 97 that I understand gave the book its life.
That's right, Philip. This was the first case that really captured my imagination, because in fact, while I'm sitting here holding my book, the last in the first few months after I had signed the contract, I thought maybe the book would never happen, because in contrast to my experience with previous books, I found that the scientists in Singapore and Hong Kong and Malaysia didn't want to talk to me. And I found
well,
that...
Well, you are a troublemaker, Liz.
Well, I'm a spoiled troublemaker, clearly, because I just had a terrific run with the two previous books, even though I wasn't particularly well known at that point. But the scientists that I approached were trusting. I assured them that I would show them what I'd written, and the arrangements always went very well. So I sort of waltzed in to Asia thinking this would happen again, and it didn't.
When you were last on the program, heavens above, in 2011, we were discussing cold case files, which chooses cases from here, the UK, US. And you mentioned that when it comes to murder, there are some specific national characteristics. Okay. How is Asia different to the West?
Well, the key thing is the geographical layout of places like Singapore and Hong Kong, as opposed to a place like Australia. Like in Australia, when you murder your spouse, well, it's a bit of an Australian ritual. You can throw the body into the back of the ute and head for the hills and, you know, find a space where you can dig your legendary shallow grave. And in Hong Kong or in Singapore, where...
Tiny apartments.
So for a start, you have to commit the murder in a very confined space. So, I mean, again, they're those kitchen cleavers tend to be the murder weapon of choice.
So dismemberment is the go. And then you throw
yes.
the bits and pieces into a river.
Well, that's right. And you also in small packages, because, again, you don't want to be observed. In fact, there was one case in the book which I call the eye of the CCTV camera sees all, where Singapore police, who are extremely good at this sort of thing, managed to find out how a headless and handless body had been thrown into the water by scanning the CCTV cameras and realising that the unfortunate woman who'd been killed had actually been stuffed into a suitcase and then thrown into the water.
So there's lots of these CCTV cameras around.
Singapore is pretty much a police state, as you would be aware, but they do their policing very well. They are very effective.
Okay, let's look at Singapore for a minute, because it's interesting that Singapore uses judges instead of juries for its verdict. And, of course, they're notorious for prolific use of capital punishment. Does this affect the way cases are handled?
Well, I mean, the fact that there is no jury is a different issue for the lawyers, but it does create a bit of an issue for the forensic scientists giving evidence, however, because there's a lot more to worry about when you feel like you have somebody's life in your hands, and if the case doesn't go well, that they will die.
Is trial by judges alone more reliable? That sounds a bit like the French model.
Well, I actually have slightly sometimes unconventional views about the jury system because I've come across several cases through my books where the jury system hasn't worked terribly well. I mean, we have a case, there's a New South Wales case in my book about a very unfortunate young Singaporean man called Ram Tiwari, who was accused of murdering his two flatmates. And it took three trials, or two trials and two appeals, before a panel of three judges could see what, in my view, was there to be seen all along.
So this guy spent 8 years in a New South Wales jail for a murder he didn't commit.
Yes, and to me and to the three judges at the end and to his lawyers, the forensic evidence was pretty clear. It was a case, to quote the Sherlock Holmes story of the curious incident of the dog in the night.
Yes.
It's a case where it was the absence, as in the Sherlock Holmes case, it was the fact that the dog didn't bark meant something. And here it was the case that this young man had virtually no blood on him, and yet he was supposed to have murdered two men in the most brutal fashion with a baseball bat. It was
we know that Conan Doyle did some training in Edinburgh earlier on before he conceived of the Sherlock Holmes character. And of course, we see the beginning of forensics at that era. They're not entirely new, are they? I mean, fingerprints, for God's sake.
That's right. But of course, the huge development of our era is DNA. But I mean, still, some of the most magic kinds of discoveries don't include DNA. For example, you mentioned the Bali bombing at the beginning of
Don't rush into that because I want to tease that out shortly.
Okay,
so
all right.
Let's stick with Ram.
Okay, stick with Ram. So what would you like me to tell you about Ram?
Well, how did this evidence come up? Who found it?
Well, it was really who found the evidence was, or the lack of evidence was always there from the beginning. He was accused of murdering, as I said, his two flatmates. He slept through the first murder, he reckons, and he woke up to terrible noises outside his bedroom door. And fatally, he actually didn't go out to investigate. And it was only when silence had fallen again that he went out. And that's when he found the two bodies.
But Liz, a great many people choose not to go out in cities across the world.
Oh, absolutely. But it was the fact that he was portrayed when it came to trial. He was portrayed by the prosecution as a liar because he had told friends of his afterwards that he hadn't witnessed the murders, or he hadn't been there, because he was ashamed that he hadn't, when he'd heard these noises in his own apartment, and he was a young man with military training, he'd been too afraid to go out and intervene. And the prosecution used that, the fact that he told stories to kind of protect himself, to try and portray him as a liar.
LNL on RN, on digital radio and online, where we are often very forensic. My guest is award-winning crime journalist Liz Porter, who has authored her third book, Crime Scene Asia, subtitled When Forensic Evidence Becomes the Silent Witness. Liz, let's now move to the Bali bombings, as mentioned in the intro. The partnership between the Australian Fed and the Indonesian investigators was coined Operation Alliance, but that was a misnomer.
That's right. The scientists of both countries were supposedly working together. But to be fair to the Indonesians, it was their country and it was their jurisdiction. But there were tensions, shall we say, between the two teams. And certainly the Australians were told from the very beginning that this was not their crime scene and that they were to wait until the Indonesians had finished processing it, until they were to go in. But this isn't what happened.
I must say in parentheses, but that I'm no great admirer of the AFP and its joint operations with Bali, because that leads to that catastrophic case where a few Australians were shot. But, okay, let's just stay with this. From the first moment of their arrival, they were made aware of their subordinate status in the Indonesian investigation. Well, as you say, that's fair.
Yes, absolutely. So on the first day that the Australians arrived, and my key source in this chapter is a fabulous scientist called David Royds.
There was a movie made, was there not, of David's role?
Well, no, there was supposed to be a movie made. And if this movie had been made, then he would have been practically a household name, because that fabulous actor Richard Roxburgh was to play him. And in fact, filming had started in 2005, and unfortunately, some more bombs went off, and the Balinese governor shut down that operation, because the kind of discoveries that David made were worthy of a Hollywood film script.
Let's look at them. So here's David, chief scientist for our mob. He manages to sneak into the crime scene at Paddy's bar where the first bomb had exploded, and he finds spatters of blood and soot on the ceiling. And he interprets this as more than a hint of a suicide bomb.
That's right. Everybody else at the scene was looking at the floor, and he looked upwards and saw the blood spatter and the soot on the ceiling. And then, crucially, he started looking around. And again, remember, he wasn't supposed to be in there. He had a cup in his hand and he was pretending to drink from it. And he's looking around and he sees two copper wires on the ground, and he notices that they are the typical sort of wires you'd expect from a detonator of a bomb. He picks them up and he puts them into his cup and continues to pretend to drink.
But Liz, it has to be said that in due course he accidentally puts the wires into the washing machine.
That is right. Well, it's been a long day for him, Philip, as you understand, and he puts them in an envelope in his overalls, and at the end of the day, he's back in his hotel room at the Kartika Plaza, crashes out, and is unable to sleep because the smell of his sweaty overalls is like a second presence in the room. He gets up, he washes them. The next morning, he wakes up and he finds the sodden remains of the envelope in his overalls. Fortunately for him, two things: the explosive traces on the wires were TNT, which is not soluble in water, and secondly, when he gets those wires under the microscope the next day, he sees there are fragments of cotton attached to the wires.
Well, that suggests that the bomb had been wrapped in fabric.
That's right. And his theory is that it's been the vest of a suicide bomber, and everything else that is subsequently discovered points to that.
Well, now we get into big time politics, because while the terrorist group of Jamaah Islamiyah was known, it was deemed inactive or not yet active in Indonesia by the authorities. This is the last thing they want to hear.
Exactly right. And in fact, some weeks afterwards, a press conference is held, and the head of the investigation, Graham Ashton, who's now the Chief Commissioner of Police in Victoria, actually specifically scotches the idea of it being a suicide bomber.
Why, Liz? Because, why does he do that?
Well, because the Indonesians did not want to admit that Jemaah Islamiyah was as yet active in Indonesia, and until it could be absolutely proven, they just weren't going to admit it. But of course, eventually, it was proven. They discovered that all the DNA from the blood and soot on the ceiling didn't match any of the known people to have died in the blast. They found the body of the remnants of a suicide bomber.
This is body 006A.
That's right. And so the forensic pathologist, while the suicide bombing scenario was being specifically denied, the forensic pathologists were still working away on, by then, the body parts, and had in the first place identified that there was a segments of a body left which bore all the hallmarks of having been a suicide bomber. And gradually, at the same time, the bombers had been captured through some excellent work by the Indonesians, identifying the man who had actually bought the van to carry the bombs. And so then there was a confession which said, acknowledged that a suicide bomber had been involved. So then David Royds had the scientific evidence to back that up. So it could no longer be denied.
Okay. Now, we talked about the fact that the film wasn't made. It's probably not too late to have a look at it. But how good are the forensic labs in Asia?
Well, again, they vary. I mean, in Singapore, the standards are very high. The Singapore Health Sciences Authority is actually a teaching institution. I mean, look, even in Malaysia, from what I could see, the forensic evidence was pretty interesting and pretty well done. But sometimes what happened there was that what the police wanted that evidence to say was not justified. And there were a couple of cases in Malaysia where I felt the courts were fabulous, and while the police were trying to unfairly charge people, or in one of the cases in the book, a bloke is accused of murdering his lover, and the police would have had him in jail.
This is the case where Johan Dufleu's evidence literally saves the bloke from the gallows.
Oh, that's the Singapore case, yes, that's one. But the case I'm thinking of in Malaysia, where a particular police investigator was determined that a man had murdered his lover and didn't want to look at the fact that there was evidence and a witness that another man had been there. The DNA told them that, in fact, another man besides the dead woman's lover had been there. And the judges actually were happy to look at that, and they acquitted the bloke, found no case to answer, and the police continued to appeal. But so the forensic work that was done in that Malaysian lab was also very good.
You know, the ABC will soon be a crime scene, as I'm sure you're aware. There are moves to close us down, and I'm waiting for the tape to go up around the place. And I would like you on the case, because I want DNA evidence of the culprits. Are you available for that commission?
For you, Philip, always.
Okay. Award-winning crime journalist Liz Porter. 3 books. The third, hold it up to the camera, please, Liz, to the microphone, rather. The third book is Crime Scene Asia, When Forensic Evidence Becomes the Silent Witness, and it's out now through Blue Sky Publishing. Before I let you go, it's not only getting people in the slammer for being guilty, it's just as important to get the innocent, even more important to get the innocent out.
Absolutely. And that's what forensic evidence, when properly interpreted, will show the truth.